Hello, and welcome to Candid Conversations, Catalyst McGill's International Development Podcast. On this podcast, we explore current issues in international development around the world. I'm your host, Maisie, a third-year international development studies student at McGill University.
And I'm your other host, Carla, a third-year political science student at McGill. On today's episode of Candid Conversations, Maisie and I, alongside Sophia Khanna, Creative Director of Catalyst, got the opportunity to sit down and talk to Bart Edish, a professor of practice at McGill University.
Today we are joined by Professor Edish, where we will be discussing his new article, What a World of Difference a Little Foresight Could Make, and his research on strategic foresight and international development cooperation agents. Professor Edish is a professor of practice at McGill University. He is also a political analyst, commentator, and the author of Learning from Tomorrow, Using Strategic Foresight to Prepare for the Next Big Disruption. Thank you so much for joining us today, Professor Edish.
Maisie, Carla, thank you for the invitation. I really look forward to our conversation.
Thank you. A first question before we really get into the article. Could you please explain to us what is a professor of practice?
Professor of practice is a term that's been coined by the Institute for the Study of International Development here at McGill. And it's essentially a roster of experts who have had practical experience in the development world. So in contrast to, say, a full-time tenured faculty member who has followed perhaps a more academic career, getting their PhD and then writing and publishing and teaching and such, professors of practice tend to be not so much academic as much as practitioners. So you have people, for example, who have this role at McGill, who have worked for the United Nations, who have worked for Global Affairs Canada and its predecessor, or in my case, the Asian Development Bank, where I spent about 20 years. And I continue to work in the field of international development as a consultant, working for various multilateral development banks. So we play kind of an advisory role. We don't tend to teach full-time courses, but we mentor students. We write articles. We speak on behalf of the university. We do guest lectures and basically help out where we can in actually a volunteer fashion.
That's really interesting. Now getting a bit into your article and your research, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So one of my areas of specialty is strategic foresight. And it's a term that's a bit of a mystery to a lot of people. So let me try to demystify it if I can to get us started. So strategic foresight, or just to make things a little more simple, foresight is a structured and systematic way of using ideas about the future to better anticipate and prepare for change. So it's a multidisciplinary type of approach, and it's used to typically develop alternative, plausible scenarios on where things might be in 10 or more years. So it's sometimes confused with forecasting, which is very different. Forecasting, think of in the business world, forecasting they often do for the next quarter or the next year, what are expected sales and revenue and stock price, etc. And forecasts tend to be based on historical data, right? Whereas foresight looks at big drivers of change as well as uncertainties, and through different types of techniques generates a handful of scenarios that provide a picture of how the world might unfold around a particular topic that you choose at the beginning of a foresight exercise. And just to round up this initial explanation, an example of an issue that might be studied is how might higher education be delivered in the year 2035? Or how might the urban transport systems in Ontario operate in 2040? Imagining between now and then, we could have, for example, autonomous vehicles, we could have more hybrid vehicles and electric EVs, different forms of transport, fewer, more cars. It would be an exploration of the different possibilities driven, again, by major changes and certain uncertainties.
Do you have any specific example where, you know, the utilization of foresight could be used to, you know, shape public policy?
Absolutely. So what I do is I look at the application of foresight to international development. It's actually applied to many different sectors and themes, and it received quite a boost during COVID times. So COVID shook up our world, right? And we were already at a time that could be described as VUCA, V for volatile, U for uncertainty, C for complexity, and A for ambiguity. And then COVID came along and shook up everything. And so since COVID times, a lot more corporations and businesses and international organizations have started to tap into foresight to get an idea of what might be the next big disruption. That was the purpose of the book I wrote a couple of years ago, was to introduce people to foresight and show how it was being used and why COVID kind of highlighted the need for every organization to consider what might transpire 10, 15 years out, not just like the next revenue period or next academic year or what have you, but look a little bit further out. So a practical example in the field of international development. So like many Western countries, including Canada, France has an International Development Cooperation Agency. It goes by the acronym AFD, so it's the French Development Agency. And in 2014, they launched a strategic foresight exercise that involved hundreds of their staff all across the organization and their headquarters in Paris and in field offices in the developing world. And what the purpose of this was to look at in the year 2025, again, this is a starting point of 2014, so 11 years ahead, to get an idea of how might things be different in that future world, and then how should we, the French Development Agency, adapt the way that we're providing support to countries around the world. So that exercise went through, as is typical for a big foresight exercise, a number of different workshops, collecting ideas, identifying trends, and whittling down what are the most important uncertainties and the biggest drivers. And the result was a handful of scenarios that could inform senior management as they were setting forth new plans and strategies to keep in mind these are possible worlds in the future. But that's an example. Other development agencies, I'll give you just one other quick example. There's an institution, an organization called the Inter-American Development Bank. This is one of the multilateral development banks. It's owned by many different countries. It's a public institution, and it provides financing and technical support, capacity development to countries, in this case, in Latin America, the Caribbean, and Central America. So they're promoting social and physical infrastructure and trying to fight poverty. So what the IADB, Inter-American Development Bank, does is when they prepare country strategies, they will often incorporate scenario development to help envision where this country might be at in the next 5, 10, 15 years to help inform the planning for how IADB provides support to the country in the next handful of years. So you look actually beyond the period that you're dealing with at the moment, but you're looking at where the future might unfold.
That's super interesting. Just going a bit deeper into foresight, would you say that there are any like issues with predicting like scenarios in the future? What would you say those are? Any issues in foresight?
Sure, absolutely. So the people who work in foresight, they tend to distinguish themselves from a crystal ball, and they tend not to use the term predict. So unlike a forecast, so forecasts can be very precise. So we, the forecast increase in gross domestic product in Canada next year might be 3.4%. So it's very precise. You will never find that in a foresight exercise. Typically, what you get through the process is a narrative, is a story. It's a lot about storytelling, describing how things might unfold. And there's no effort to predict with extreme accuracy, this is exactly how it's going to appear. But rather, it gains its plausibility. It has credibility because you are basing that scenario on ways that certain drivers of change. And let me give an example of a driver of change. It might be climate change. So fundamental structural changes around us. Another one might be demographic change. So we're living at a time that's aging populations, and you also have more migration and refugees than we've seen ever before. There are other examples, but those are just a couple. So what are some of the potential problems? Well, there are so many potential drivers of change and trends to analyze, it can be a challenge to whittle down because you can't be dealing with 80 or 100. It's too much to encompass, and you're only going to, at the end of the process, have a handful of scenarios that tell a coherent story, and there'll be different stories. So that's one of the challenges. Another challenge is to ensure that you have participation of different perspectives. You've heard of the wisdom of the masses, crowdsourcing of ideas, and oftentimes that will yield a more accurate or more insightful perspective. And so similarly with foresight, and I had given the example of what the French Development Agency did many years ago, they brought in their experts across regions and across specialties to ensure that different perspectives fed into the foresight exercise. So if you're looking at how might education unfold and how might it be delivered at the university level in 2035, you would obviously want to have people who are experts on education and have given some thought to the future, but you might also involve economists, sociologists, psychologists, demographers, to gain different perspectives that could be valuable in shaping potential scenarios.
Something that I was thinking about, because I'm Haitian, which, you know, is a developing nation, and trying to, you know, think of foresight and how, in the case of a country where there isn't much stability, how would foresight be particularly implementing policy, envisioning long-term international development?
Right. So I'm not personally familiar with an example of foresight being applied to Haiti, but I would not be surprised if it has been. In fact, I would expect that somebody has tried to do it, maybe a development organization or government agency, non-profit organization. So there, things are very difficult right now in Haiti, as you well know, right?
Yeah.
And they have been for a number of years. But just because it has been, that's the past tense, and they are now, that doesn't, the present doesn't necessarily foretell the future, right? There can be evolutions. So a foresight exercise might be looking at these trends, including the demographic ones, the brain drain, the lack of good governance, instability, crime, et cetera, all these various problems, but also look at, well, what could be changes around Haiti that open up doors? So are there new ways of, can technology, for example, improve the plight of the population? Are there new ways of addressing, say, hunger and poverty, job opportunities that could evolve with changes around us in society and new opportunities that could emerge? So it would be looking a bit, foresight looks outside of the box at things that may not be evident on the table here before us. What we recognize is, oh, in this case, here's Haiti, here's the situation they're in, and we extrapolate where it's going to go. That's like a forecast. That's a straight line prediction. That's not foresight, which looks at, yeah, things could continue to be very difficult in 10 or 15 years, but there is probably a plausible scenario where things are actually much better in Haiti, that there's hope, that there's progress, right? And indeed, one of the great things about foresight, it helps to emphasize that we have agency, that the future is not already told. So we can envision these different scenarios, none of which may come to pass, but they could come to pass. Again, because there's the tools that are used to build those scenarios are credible, and they incorporate perspectives and evidence and insights and looking at how different trends and drivers might interact. So in short, that's what I say about the example of Haiti. Any kind of scenarios that would be done would look at not just, you know, things have been bad and so they're going to remain bad, but what are the changes be well beyond Haiti in, say, a broader system in the world that could contribute to improvements that we can't see necessarily day to day today?
Would you say it's easier to sort of convince, you know, these NGOs, nonprofits to try to implement, you know, foresight than it is to say an official governmental body of, say, like a nation?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And in fact, you tend to see foresight used more by governments and by international organizations and by companies than you do by NGOs. Some of them are starting to use it. But, you know, there are big challenges. Regardless of the organization, there are a number of challenges with foresight. For one thing, because of its emphasis on thinking outside the box and in a time period, typically, it's not hard and fast, but typically you're looking 10 or more years out. If you start letting your imagination go, you can come up with some kind of crazy ideas. Well, what seemed like crazy today. And if you're not coming up with something that sounds a little bit crazy, then you're not being realistic. Because if you go back 10 or 15 years, some of the things we live with today and take for granted would seem like quite a surprise. Like shops that you walk into, and there are some, not necessarily in Montreal, there's nobody there, and you just walk in, take your products, and the price is recorded digitally, electronically, and you walk out. In Austria, for example, I'm getting a little bit away from international development, but just to highlight that what we may see in the future could surprise us. In a supermarket in Austria, maybe few, you can now buy 3D printed vegan salmon. Well, put your head around that. There are cities in the United States where you can get in an autonomous vehicle, like an Uber-type vehicle, and be driven from destination to B, A to B, without a driver. In Queensland, one of the states in Australia, in the southeast part of that state, there is a community near Brisbane, the capital, that receives thousands of drone deliveries every few months. It's a regular thing that drones are delivering sandwiches and boxes of chicken and drinks and other things. So this brings to mind a quote by a fellow named William Gibson. He says, "The future is already here. It's just unevenly distributed." So we can begin to see elements of the future that seem a little bit wacky that in 10 years' time may be commonplace and actually have been superseded. ChatGPT, 2 years ago, a year ago, were we talking about this or some of its rivals? And artificial intelligence, generative AI, is going to become an increasingly influential part of all of our work lives. But to come quickly back to your question, is it easier for NGOs to adopt it? I haven't seen that, actually. I've seen government agencies in different countries picking it up. In fact, one of the best examples in the world of a central government investing in strategic foresight, like hiring staff, doing research, providing capacity building around the government agencies and departments, is here in Canada, where in Ottawa you have an outfit called Policy Horizons, which is a global example of good quality strategic foresight. And their reports are shared with senior people in the government, whatever the government of the day happens to be, as well as civil servants, to inform them in their areas of responsibility to influence policy, at least to make sure that policy, that as it's being developed, is thinking about where things may be going.
And why is that it's easier for government agencies to implement foresight, if you had to guess, of course?
Yeah, I think part of it has to be, you know, it has to do with governments. They have resources that they can tap into budgets in a way that many NGOs cannot. There are obviously some very large NGOs that could invest in foresight, and some have. But governments have, in some cases, tens of hundreds of thousands of employees and very large budgets, and they already have processes to develop strategies, policies, plans, and to do risk management. And strategic foresight is just another way to assist all of that. And so, with those resources, which many NGOs could only begin to dream of, they can invest in this space. But it's becoming more widespread, and especially in the corporate sector. Corporate foresight is massive. I came back 2 days ago from the Middle East, where I was attending the Dubai Future Forum. So what is this all about? This is the largest annual gathering of futurists in the world. And so strategic foresight is kind of a subset of futurism. Futurism, think of it as the encompassing body, people who are thinking where things might go. What does the future hold in store? Okay, and how can we build a better future? Foresight is kind of the practical application using specific tools. And at this event, you had various panel discussions involving people from the corporate sector who are doing foresight. Now, why would you have that? Things are changing so quickly in terms of consumer appetite and various trends that companies, and examples here would be like McDonald's, Jaguar and Land Rover, a Lego, looking at where might trends go in a decade that would potentially affect our business substantially and how should we adapt. And obviously governments have a somewhat different perspective. They're thinking more about how to prepare to serve their populations and implement responsible policies with a long-term view.
How did you get into the field of foresight? Because it's not like a course, at least not at McGill, it's not like a course that's like, you know, offered here.
Maybe it should be, and that's the subject of another discussion. So my personal journey starts in a development organization, which explains maybe why I focus a lot of my time and research and thinking on how foresights apply to development, even though it's applied in other places as well. So 6 years ago, I was overseeing the knowledge management team at the Asian Development Bank, which is a bit like the Inter-American Development Bank I just talked about, except it obviously works in the Asia-Pacific region. So it brings together 68 countries, mostly from that region, but also in Western Europe and North America and elsewhere, providing resources to finance basic physical infrastructure and address social challenges and to improve livelihoods and prosperity in Asia and the Pacific. So while managing our knowledge team, we brought in an expert an internationally recognized expert on strategic foresight. One of my staff had been exposed to this and said, look, we really should bring this into our organization, which hadn't really dealt with strategic foresight before. We brought in a specialist, found 24 staff who were interested in an introductory course, if you will, the basics of foresight. And that began the process in August of 2017. And from there, I moved on to another role in that organization, but my successor picked it up and ran with it. And now the Asian Development Bank is one of the, I guess, go-to examples of how a development organization is using foresight to develop strategies, to anticipate areas of risk, and to make better policy, basically. That's how I got into it. That stimulated my interest. I continued to do research and build up networks. And during COVID, I wrote a book, basically a primer on foresight, which Maisie mentioned at the outset, Learning from Tomorrow. And so that's kind of Foresight 101 with a number of practical examples of how it's been used, including in COVID times when people were wondering, how do we get out of this mess and what's going to come next?
Do you see foresight being used more and more in academia, teaching it to people? I wouldn't say it's wishful thinking, but do you see that sort of in the future of international development studies, of introducing people to using foresight, studying foresight?
I would like to think so. It has not crept into development studies as much as I think it should, because, look, those who are studying development, often students, they're thinking of one day I want to work for a development organization. And as I pointed out, and as my research is highlighting, more and more development organizations are doing foresight. So shouldn't we be preparing the students who are studying development to practice these techniques, which are being increasingly embraced? There are a number of organizations, semi-academic, some are private, some are nonprofit, that are promoting awareness, futures literacy. That's kind of terminology that's used, especially by UNESCO, which has a Canadian head leading futures literacy work. So trying to get people thinking, you know, beyond today. In the development context, as I said, I'm not aware of any development programs that really consistently promote foresight education. Now, if we take foresight generically, in Canada, you have a university that gives degrees, master's degrees in foresight. That's OCAD. That's the Ontario College of Art and Design. So OCAD, actually, you can go there and get a master's degree in foresight. The most famous places, universities in the United States that do the same thing are in Hawaii and the University of Houston in Texas. There are others elsewhere in the world, but not a whole lot that issue degrees. But you can get a degree. And many people will, because they're transitioning from another sector or they want to complement their current skills, they'll take a certification course, and you can do a lot of things online. You can, actually, there's so many free resources, including training modules, for example, offered by Policy Horizons, the Canadian government unit. You don't necessarily need to go get a degree to learn a bit about foresight.
What exactly is, like, the process behind foresight, and what kind of methods do you use?
Well, the foresight process starts with asking a question, typically, and I had alluded to that. So how might higher education be delivered in 2035? So you start with the question, and then you begin to look at, you do some horizon scanning. So what are some of the weak signals emerging that could be relevant to this future space? What's a weak signal? A weak signal is it's something, an oddity, something that's a little bit, catches your attention, it's a little bit out of place. It might be a sliver of the future today. So think about the first time, this is not relevant to development or education per se, but the first time you walked into a fast food restaurant or into an airport and instead of walking up to the counter to meet somebody there to assist you, take your order or check you in for a flight, you encountered a kiosk. So the first time you may have noticed that, it's like, that was a little jarring. This is something different. What's going on here? And now we've seen this proliferate, and we're going to see it proliferate even more. It was the beginning of automation. So these signs of the future, weak signals, or emerging trends, this is something else in the foresight process you would begin to note. Often, I have to say that foresight processes, there's great flexibility. It's not very rote. There are many different techniques you can bring in. It depends on what the goals of the study are. Okay? In some cases, you may just want to examine the assumptions that are underlying your policy. On the other hand, you may want to do a full-fledged report. Coming back to this example of in 2035, how is education going to be delivered at the post-secondary level? So you would move from the question, You're doing horizon scanning. Where might there be emerging trends or examples of a potential future that you would incorporate into your thinking? You identify key trends and drivers of change, including some that have nothing to do with education, or not obviously, but you would want to if you're looking at education. You'd want to look at demography, you'd want to look at technological inputs, you want to look at trends of people learning beyond the traditional ages for college or university, right? You have lifelong learning now. You have older people who are studying, and because of how fast markets, labor markets are changing, the idea of going to college, university, getting a degree, and then that's more or less it, those days are gone. You have to continue learning. So that would be factored into some foresight study. Eventually, you work your way to a point where you're, again, using different tools, you are elaborating scenarios, typically 3 to 5, internally consistent scenarios that have certain assumptions built in, like some of these trends and drivers of change, but they all point to a somewhat different direction. And again, they're not intended to be predictive. But I'll give you an example where sometimes it can be eerie how well they predict, even if that is not the intention. In 2010, the Rockefeller Foundation did a study on technology and development. You can find it on the web. And among the scenarios, 3 or 4 in the future, they predicted a worldwide pandemic that would cause extensive mortality, major travel disruptions, and China would come out of it better than many others, and that there would be all these blockages at borders and restrictions on mobility. Basically, as you read this scenario, one of a few, back in 2010, it was as if you were reading in 2020 during COVID. It's like, how did they know that? And again, it wasn't prediction, but they could see in certain scenarios that factors could come together to create a worldwide pandemic that would shake things up. And that's just one of many examples where foresight, you know, pointed to something that would happen. One other example quickly, if I may. So one of the early corporations to embrace foresight was the Royal Dutch Shell Corporation, so oil producers. And in the early 1970s, they started using scenarios, which is a, you know, key element of foresight. And they got some great thinkers looking at how the world was evolving and how things might interact. And one of their scenarios was that there would be that the oil producing nations in the Middle East would constrict oil supply and create a crisis. And they also were able to identify what were some of the goalposts along the way. What were some of the signs? If that was the direction things were going, what might we see today pointing to a scenario where there is this basically global crisis, which did happen in the early to mid-70s. So because of this foresight work, Shell was better prepared than any other major oil firm because they anticipated the possibility that this scenario would happen. And the critical thing is because if you've got a few different scenarios, well, which one is it going to be? They were able to identify the signposts leading to that scenario. It became increasingly clear that's actually what's going
to
happen.
How is like the accessibility to data as it comes to foresight? Is that really, really important, sort of being able to access data to, you know, analyze trends,
sure,
make connections?
Absolutely. And the more analysis you have, the more data you have to draw upon, the more robust your foresight work will be. I come back to highlighting that foresight, again, is not forecasting. Yeah. And forecasting depends on data. This is what happened the last few years, and so that's what's going to happen next year. Straight line predictions. Foresight does not exclude the use of historical data. In fact, it draws upon it. And it does take into account trends. But it does not slavishly follow them. And it looks at how, again, different kinds of drivers might interact in different ways to create a future that we don't necessarily see today. You were asking about tools earlier, and there are things called cascade diagrams or the futures wheel that you can use in your own life. You can use it with an organization, you can use it anywhere. And the idea is you look at a first order consequence. So something you're seeing more talk of these days is the development of a 4-day work week. Right? Have you heard of this concept?
Yeah.
More and more companies are adopting 4-day work weeks, and there are a number of pilot tests, experiments taking place around the world where people would work 4 days instead of 5 and work basically 8 hours less. So instead of working, say they work 40, they work 32, and they get paid the same. There's no cut in pay. And you think that's kind of crazy. But they're finding, there's different aspects to this, but they're finding that actually this can improve morale. People have more time to deal with their families and engage, and therefore more motivated and focused when they come to the office. So an example of using the futures wheel would be to, okay, what would happen if the four-day work week were adopted everywhere, that it became mainstream? Okay, you would start with that. What would be a consequence of that? And you could try to identify all kinds of consequences, speculate, okay, well, if it's a four-day work week, then people have an extra day, there might be less traffic down to the office, people might use daycare less. I mean, there's a number of immediate consequences you could envision. And then you actually go a step beyond that. So if that's that first thing you identify, whichever you've picked up on, that, okay, people, there's less demand on daycare services, which has an implication for those who are offering that, as that's their livelihood. They run a daycare center, or the government may, you know, sponsor that. Okay, what happens if there's less use of daycare centers? And then you look at what would that lead to? So you basically look at a second and third order consequence, and that begins to stretch your mind about different future possibilities. And it's not that difficult a tool to use, but you can suddenly find yourself talking about scenarios that just in a normal conversation where we're focused on the here and now or tomorrow or next week's exam, we don't really piece together how one consequence could lead to another consequence could lead to another consequence, and suddenly we've got a potentially very different world. And that's one of the tools that's useful in foresight.
What advice would you give to any student looking to get into studying foresight?
Pick up my book. Authors have to be shameless self-promoters, yeah. But you don't even have to do that because there's so much readily available on the internet. And given that many of your listeners are in Canada, I would encourage them to go to the website. They or their parents are paying tax dollars that support the work of Policy Horizons, the federal government's foresight body. And there are a wealth of resources, including some very interesting reports on different subject areas looking into the future that are publicly available. And they have a whole resource center, including a kit. You could teach a course, and the materials are there for you to use. So I'd say start there to get a taste. And then there are a number of different courses that are available at low cost, on sites like Udemy, Udemy, or you can take, like, Coursera offers courses as well, picking up from one of the institutions, universities or specialized and non-government organizations that specialize in foresight practice.
I actually had a question. When it comes to this web of possibilities, at what point do you stop? Like, I feel like it could just go on and on and on and on forever. So where do you draw the line and say, okay, this is the most plausible thing that we can predict?
That's an astute observation. And this is why it's important, if you're undertaking a major foresight exercise, to have trained facilitators and people familiar with the different tools that one can use. You start with an open book and with open brainstorming and ideas, okay? And then you begin to whittle them down, and typically that's done with the group that's involved in the exercise. So you may come up with, you know, 80, 100 examples. I pointed to this example in development by the French Development Agency, and initially they had crazy numbers of ideas of things that could happen, of major trends. But then kind of, not the crowdsourcing, but the idea of a participatory exercise where people would start whittling through them and come up with, okay, well, you know, maybe that's less likely than this one, or this one's more important than that one. And you whittle down to what is a more manageable number, and we work with that to eventually feed into the scenarios. Look, again, foresight is not telling you this is what the future will be, okay? So you're not, no matter what you do, you cannot predict 10 years out exactly what's gonna happen. But foresight can give you some plausible scenarios. What's most likely, based on past history, because now foresight's been operating for several decades, is you will find scenarios that have an element of reality in the end. So if you come up with three or four scenarios, and then you come back 10, 15 years later, and, well, what happened? You can see parts of some scenarios that, yeah, that's actually what happened. But it's not like one, usually it's not one scenario got it all right. But it's not a matter of getting it right. It's more getting people to think about what could happen. And you don't put the study aside and wait 10 years and see what happens. You continually track between now and then. You're doing horizon scanning. You're looking for the appearance of changes around you that could signify change. So it's a dynamic, ongoing process that might be interspersed with a major exercise looking 10 years out. One other thing, if I may.
Yes.
So what if you're interested in kind of big picture thinking about, well, what are these trends? Where's the world going to go? The intelligence agencies in the United States, specifically the National Intelligence Council, there's a lot of intelligence parts of the U.S. government. This one, the National Intelligence Council, every 4 years, they do a big mega trend study. And the idea is that they make this publicly available. So the spooks are actually publishing this stuff. Usually they keep these things quiet, but they put out a massive report where they've had all these resources to do interviews with experts all over the world, and they drop scenarios, in this case five, for basically 20 years out. It's an absolutely phenomenal, insightful read that gets you thinking about possibilities and highlights key drivers of change and uncertainties. And they do it every 4 years because it's intended to inform each new U.S. government administration. So there's a presidential election every 4 years, and they want to have this report ready for the new administration to consider. This is where the world may be going. But they update it every 4 years. That doesn't mean they stop working in between. It's just that they update the report. And it's one of the few examples of a publicly available in-depth foresight report that gives you thought out perspective on where the world might be going. So it's called Global Trends, National Intelligence Council.
I have one more question if we have time for it. Where does climate change kind of, where does it sit in this prediction? Because it might be very unpredictable and it's hard to foresee with all these changes.
So. Sure. Okay. Well, those best situated to analyze how the climate is changing, climate scientists, they have overwhelmingly come to a consensus about the trends, about where things are going, about the need to restrain emissions of carbon and other elements. And so any kind of a foresight study, and increasingly, regardless of the sector, climate change is coming into play. So you would factor into that foresight study, what do we know? What's the best available evidence about climate change? And so even the best climate studies cannot predict exactly what's going to happen. Because it's going to be variable depending on microclimates, geographies, and a number of conditions, and whether or not humanity, political leaders, decision makers, corporations, etc., get their act together to reduce emissions. But that's not the work of the foresight folks studying where the climate will how it will unfold. But a foresight study, depending on what it is, could well incorporate the latest thinking and expert advice and insight as to trends. And so you will see, if you take a look at that study I mentioned to you on, you know, mega trends that done by the intelligence folks in Washington, climate change figures very prominently. And even if you have an idea of how it might, things that could be disruptive, like rising sea levels and more intense storms and such, how that plays out for economies and politics and society, that we don't really know for sure. And that's where foresight is helpful to analyze. Okay, this is the best environmental, the scientific evidence as of today, but how might other human factors and how we organize ourselves, how we govern ourselves, how we do the market, free market, or regulated market, how might that all interact to affect our lives and future economy and how we cooperate?
Professor Edish, thank you so much for being with us. You can pick up his book, Learning from Tomorrow, Using Strategic Foresight to Prepare for the Next Big Disruption. And you can also follow him on Medium at Bart Edish or Big Trends Guy. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you once again to Professor Edish, and thank you for listening to this episode of Candid Conversations. Candid Conversations is a Catalyst McGill production. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn at Catalyst McGill, and you can find us on Instagram at IDSSA Publications.